Introduce our main speaker, Chuck G from North Hollywood.
My name is Chuck Guerrero. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be here. My sobriety date is June the 14th, 1993, and it is the Chuck Show tonight, right, Chuck? Grateful to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Bob, and I have a home group. It's called the Sunrise and Sunset Group, and I have a sponsor. His name is Bob D. He lives in Las Vegas, Nevada. And those are things I didn't have when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. Those are things I refused to get for a long time around Alcoholics Anonymous. I was around Alcoholics Anonymous for a really long time, and consequently, I stayed drunk, which is what happens to people like me that are chronic alcoholics. They're alcoholics of the hopeless variety, which is what I am. It's good to be in this room. I have a lot of friends here. I have a lot of really good friends here. It's like coming home. This group is like the CPR of my recovery. I came here before this group started and learned a lot from the people in this meeting that attend here regularly. And at a time when I was in a really, as the English would say, a bad patch, I don't know if I was almost out of here or not, but it's great to be here. And as a result of doing what you guys do here and importing that to the valley where I live in Los Angeles, we got an active group there, and we started another meeting, and our flagship meeting, our home group's on Thursday night at the same time. This one is, I have a good friend of mine at a podium just like this in Sherman Oaks giving a talk tonight, and so I haven't been able to come around here a lot, and I miss a lot of you, and it's been a remarkable thing that we've been able to put something together, a fellowship I crave. And I hope you find that here. I'm going to welcome you home if you're new tonight. I want to welcome you home to Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to welcome you home to recovery. I want to welcome you home to the mothership. I want to welcome you home to, I'll just go out on a limb and say magic. It's what I have found here. And if you're new tonight and you're wondering, you feel different, you're more qualified. The more different you feel, the more you belong here. And if you're here tonight and you're tired of being told, welcome back again. If your people are saying we love you and you're thinking, yeah, right, you don't know me. If you're like me, I come to meetings for years, and whenever you welcome me home, I don't buy it. It sounds like something your sponsor told you to say to me. Because if you knew who I am, you don't love me and you don't want me here, because if you know who I am, you know that I'll steal from you. If you know who I am, you know that when I go to work, I tell your stories and make fun of you. And I don't like you. I don't like people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You're too shiny, you're too happy. And you say stupid stuff like, you're happy and sober, which don't equate to me. Right? And it just sounds insincere when you say you love me and welcome home. It just sounds sincere, insincere. And I want to tell you, if you're new, welcome home. Welcome home. And I want to tell you a quick story which sums it up, because if you've heard me before, it's the same thing over and over. I'm not a speaker here. I'm a guy that walked in the doors lucky enough to stay, and I've watched some people that I adore. I have some spiritual advisors, and a lot of things I do, I've learned from them, and they work, and I keep using them. And so you may have heard some of the stuff I'm going to say tonight. I'm not original. I'm just a puking drunk who was fortunate enough to stay here for a while. But it's a story I heard a long time ago. I want to tell you it real quickly, and it makes real sense of why you're welcome here. It's a story about a place called Monterey Bay, California. If you've ever been to Monterey Bay, anybody been there before? It's a beautiful place. It's an oceanside city, and it's known for a lot of things. It's known for, it's a beautiful bay. It's known for some of the things that, the plants that are there, the horticulture. It's known for the wildlife that's there, and it's known for a bird called a pelican. Anybody ever seen a pelican? Got a big beak you can put like a half pint in? One of those. And they have these pelicans that fly around there in Monterey Bay. And years ago, they set up something called Cannery Row. You may have read the book Cannery Row. It's a wharf where they put these factories on there. And they fished. They took the fish and they gutted them and they canned the fish. And they would take the fish guts and throw them off onto this pier. And they piled up and got smelly. And what happened was the pelicans started eating the fish guts off the pier and became, you know, used to going there and having lunch and having dinner. And they started getting kind of dependent on the fish guts. And after a while, they started to become overweight. After a while, they became very complacent. Anybody relate? And they became dependent on the fisheries to feed them. And one day, a vitamin company comes into town and offers to buy the fish guts to make vitamins from. And overnight, they stopped throwing out the fish guts onto the pier. And what happened was just devastating. What happened is automatically the pelicans started starving to death. You could drive around Monterey Bay and you'd see all these pelicans look like tweaker birds or something, you know, floating around. And they were dying, man. It wasn't funny. And they had dead birds everywhere. I didn't know what to do. And the city council of Monterey hatched a plan. Here's the plan. The plan is we're going to bring baby pelicans in to repopulate the ecosystem and write the old ones off. They're dying anyway. So they bring in a bunch of baby pelicans, and what happened was just remarkable. It is the thing that we see happen every day in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings all over the world. And what took place was this. The baby pelicans instinctively knew where the source for life was. They knew how to fish. And the old ones that forgot how were retaught and revitalized through watching the baby pelicans as we do working with the newcomer. And that's why you're so welcome here. You provide a vehicle which enables guys like me to have the fire rekindled, to come alive and resense things that I desperately need to get in touch with and help me to find a power in my life. So I want to welcome you home if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous. You're in a very good group. You're with people that are like-minded and that believe in this book and this program. I know in meetings a lot people talk about their program and how they work their program. Well, try ours. It's real good. It's been working for a long time, and it's in that book. I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I don't know where I got alcoholism. I don't know how I got it. I don't know why I got it, and it really doesn't matter. I go to discussion meetings where people want to talk about how they got it, who had their family, blah, 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 and it's all nice coffee talk, I'm sure. Unfortunately, it has nothing to do with my recovery from alcoholism. Billy S. says it best. He says it doesn't matter how the mule got in the ditch. Let's just get him out. And that makes a heck of a lot of sense to me. When I was new to the Valley Club in 1991, my first real attempt at recovery, do the math, I said I'm sober in 93, you can tell I'm a quick learner here. But in 91, I came desperate to AA, I thought. And I remember being new, and this old-timer asked me, are you an alcoholic? And I said, yes, I am. And they said, do you want to live or do you want to die? End of questioning. They didn't ask me who drank in my family. And I don't know where I got alcoholism. I don't know why I got it. But I can tell you, for me, I've always been just a little bit weird. Anybody else? She's back there. I see her. And the rest of you liars. I've always been very busy. I'm a thinker. Anybody else thinking a lot? I'm a problem solver is what I am, right? I saw problems that are never going to happen, but we're going to work on them anyway, right? And I've always been very, very, I identify with you in meetings when you say you never seem to fit. Because the truth be told is, how can I ever fit with you here when I am never here with you? Where I am is in here. I'm thinking. I'm plotting and planning against the stuff that's going to happen tomorrow, or else I'm pissing and moaning remorseful at whatever crap I've been doing to people, right? And I'm restless, and I'm irritable, and I am discontent from a young age. I have to bring it up because when Bob talked about this in one of the first workshops I ever went to, I went, that's it. I am restless because I can't seem to find where it is I fit. I'm like a dog on the freeway. There's nowhere to run. And I am irritable because I am easily agitated. I don't know if you go into like Smith's here and you get in that express line, I count your stuff. I'm discontent because anything I ever get, anything I ever earn or acquire, when I finally get it, it ain't right. It just is wrong. And I grew up that way my whole life. I was raised in a place called Tulare, California, outside of Fresno. It's a farming town. It's a place you can smell before you get to. One of those places. I'm the oldest of three. My father and mother raised me and my two sisters. My dad grew up very poor. My mom was very poor. My father was a farm laborer as a child, and he helped raise his family like that, something I was extremely embarrassed of. And I don't think I ever allowed myself to even think about that until I did a four-step in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because see, what it does is it makes me feel dirty, makes me feel less than, it makes me hate myself even more. I grew up in this little family. My mom and dad educated themselves, and they gave me and my sisters every opportunity to succeed in life they didn't have, but it wasn't enough for me. I have a feeling that you owe me. I have a feeling of entitlement, and I have a feeling you don't love me right. And I grew up in this little town, and I wasn't good at sports, and I wasn't good in school. I'm a Mexican kid. I grew up in a white neighborhood. I didn't like being Mexican. I couldn't stand it. I waited for the day they would come out with like a race change operation or something to fix me. You ever think you know things? It's a dangerous business if you're an alcoholic like me, because I know something, and this is what I know. I know that if I'd been born in Las Vegas, Nevada, with light hair and blue eyes, I'd have turned out different, but looking at you guys, I can see I was wrong about that. You know, I'm not good in sports, I'm not social, and I am not a jock. I'm not good at very much at all. I'm really just one of them guys that just hangs out, and if you're like that, if you lack the ability to do good in school, you can't play sports. I don't even get sports. I don't even understand sports that involve team members. And if you're like that, what happens is you'll run off to an elite crowd at school they call stoners. Some of you know the stoners. And I never knew why they called us stoners. I just knew that these guys that were cool. And they did stuff like get in trouble. And I tell you something, I'm not good at anything, but I am good at screwing up. That's my forte. So I'm hanging out with these guys at school. I'll tell you, it's kind of pathetic. I was in junior high school, and I got kicked out or suspended for having a roach clip I had never used yet. truth be told. And at this junior high school that I'm at, it was a defining time for me because it's a time that I started discovering girls. And I remember that. I remember that feeling of realizing that girls are more than just something in school. And I remember that. And I remember we used to have, in a building just like this, we'd have a dance. They'd play phonographic records. Some of you remember records. Remember those? The young guys are going, what's a record? What's a, like an 8-track tape. Anyway, so they you guys remember 8-track tapes. Did you ever put matches in there so it wouldn't bleed the tracks? Remember that? Anyway, we're playing records, and they're having a dance in there. And every week, I'd walk into that building at lunchtime to dance with some girl. And every week, I was afraid. And every week, I left the building, and I couldn't do it. And every week I left that building, I felt the feeling inside of myself that I would come to know really well later on in life. And our book describes it. And if you're new tonight to Alcoholics Anonymous, this is your first time around here, you're going to notice that some of the words we use are kind of weird. We say really strange stuff. We use words like phenomenon of craving. The book was written a long time ago. We use stuff like obsessions of the mind, allergies of the body, stuff like self-esteem, pocketbook ambitions. And I don't know what that stuff means. I don't really pay attention. I never once in a million years walked into a bar or a crack house and said, can you give me a double rock? I'm having really slow self-esteem today, dude. You know, it just never crossed my mind. And so the words were weird when I got here. But when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous in my first meeting, one of my first meetings, they read something called Chapter 5 on page 30 of our book called More About Alcoholism. And when they read that, they read a line in that book that jumped out at me off the page, and I knew exactly what it was. And if you're here tonight, I'll see if you know what it is. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Pitiful and incomprehensible. I know that. I know what that means, and I know what that feels like. Because every time I walked out of that room after those dances, I knew that feeling of being a coward, being afraid, knowing I don't have what you have that allows you to do what you do, and hating myself for it. And vowing every week to not be that way. And doing it week after week, afraid. And I'm at a dance at a wedding one night, and they're serving booze, and I take a drink. And I take the drink not because I like the taste of alcohol. I take the drink because I have a feeling, watching my uncles, that alcohol will produce an effect that I desire and need. And I take that drink, and something happens for me. And if you're an alcoholic of my variety, you know exactly what it is that I am talking about. I take the drink, and all of a sudden, everything, every hole, every deficiency, everything wrong with me seems to be okay. Sometimes I feel like a nerd. I take a drink, I feel like a nerd. I'm not a nerd anymore. I take another drink and you're the nerd. I take another drink and you're all pretty lucky I'm even around here, right? Which really, for a guy like me, qualifies as an entire psychic change. To take me from here to there, to somebody who's cooped up in his mind, always thinking and resentful, to like, wow, it's cool, I don't care. And I can be here with you now and have fun and not care. And I love the effect produced by alcohol. I got really sick that night, got really drunk, threw up the next morning, and couldn't wait to do it again. But at that age, it's impossible to drink the way I'd like. And at the age of 15, I was drunk at a county fair, and I got my first arrest for being under the influence of alcohol and in possession, and I ended up being sentenced to an AA meeting. And that was my first meeting at 15 and a half years old. I know that sounds very young, but today we got them coming in with 8 years, and they're, you know, 15 now. But I remember going to that first meeting, and I don't know what I'm going to. I just know the judge says, you have to go. They gave me a piece of paper. I had no idea you could sign it yourself, or I would have. And I go in this room, and I remember walking up the staircase of this little scummy little house behind a Taco Bell. It was a troubled youth home in Tulare, California. And there was a guy at the door. Now I know he was a greeter. And he said, "My name is Ringo. I'm an alcoholic." And I thought, "Shh, dude, keep it down. You know, someone's going to see me in here with you guys." And I walk in the room, and I look around, and the furniture is awful. It's all mixed-matched with cigarette bowl holes in it. And I'm looking at the furniture. I look at the people. They're worse. And at 15, what I saw was this. I saw a bunch of really old, burnout people who all seemed to have a cup of coffee in each hand and two cigarettes hanging out of their mouth. And in between puffs, they cursed. It was a genuine hayride for inbreds is what it was. And I'm looking around the room, and I don't identify with anybody, and I'm watching, and this some lady starts to tell her story, this awful, horrible drunkalogue. She was an alcoholic, a heroin addict, a prostitute, and she goes on and on and on and on, and I'm listening to her, and she starts to tell why she was there. She was here to give back to the ANA, whatever that is, and she tells the story, how she had been paroled, and she was now trying to be of service, and then she told us her crime, and her crime was this. On a work night, she came home to have a couple shots of vodka like she always did. And after a couple of shots of vodka, she put her 2-year-old son in the bathtub, forgot he was there, and he had drowned. And that's exactly what I did. Oh, my God. They're worse than they look. And what happened for me was the worst thing that can happen to a guy like me with alcoholism. And that is that I began to think. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that the main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in his body. And in really plain English, because I am not a graduate guy or anything like that, what it really means is this thing doesn't work very well. I have a mind that is very, very, it's nuts is what it is. I have a mind that will rationalize and justify anything I want to do. Anybody have that mind? I have the kind of mind that I can steal from you and then convince myself that you really owe me the money anyway. Right? I have a mind that offers me solutions that are worse than the original problem that I had. You have that mind? It goes like this. I was too drunk to walk, so I... That's it. That's the mind. Coupled with the fact that I have a voice in my head. I don't know if anybody here in Las Vegas has a voice in their head or not. But if you're wondering whether or not you do, it's the voice that just said, "What voice?" That's the voice. And the voice started to talk, and this is what the voice said. The voice said, "Dude, you're not an alcoholic. Alcohol is not your problem." And how do you tell a 15-year-old dirty Mexican who doesn't get along well, who can walk into a high school beer with a high school party where they're serving keg beer? Remember keg beer? Oh, I love keg beer. And they're serving keg beer, and I am playing quarter with cheerleaders. I'm talking to the jocks. I'm singing in the band. How is that bad? I can't talk to people. I don't mix well, and it's not bad. That ain't my problem. The voice in my head says, that's not the problem. The problem is, Chuck, you got caught. Solution, do things that are more concealable than booze. It's a bust. Whenever you drink, you act a fool. You always get caught. So I tried something different. I tried smoking non-addictive marijuana. Somebody else here did too? I heard a guy say he smoked so much pot, the zigzag man had a tattoo of him on his arm. I started taking those little pills with the X's on. Remember those, the little white ones? Crosstops. Remember, you take 4, wash your car 5 times the same day, but well, who cares? You're very busy. This is, if you're new tonight, are there tweakers here tonight? Hands, tweakers? Oh, my God, I'm in Vegas. My friend says, when you go to Vegas, watch out. When you're driving into Las Vegas on the 15, those aren't chimneys, those are meth labs. Welcome home to you tweakers. This is the time we used to take crosstops. It's pharmaceutical speed, very clean, very good. And it was excellent. It's a time I call BT, before tweak. And you would take that. You wouldn't stay up 2 weeks in a row and shop all night at Walmart, that's for sure. You didn't dissect toasters, none of that crap, you know. My friend says, you know, I can tell who a real tweaker is. I said, no, how can you tell who a real tweaker is? He said, it's easy. They can thread a sewing machine while it's running. Just don't get them working on their acne. It's a bad deal. A good visual, isn't it? But welcome home if you're a tweaker. And my friend Scott does this, and I do it too, because I came to AA and I didn't know what I was. I had no clue what I was. I was doing so much stuff, and I came in here, I didn't know what it was. I had no clue. And I want to welcome you home if you have any of those other things that you're doing. I don't think they're outside issues. That is my opinion. I think that they're part and parcel of alcoholism, living in this day and age where I grew up and how we did things. And I want to welcome you home if you don't know. I want to welcome you home here and tell you that you're welcome to open meetings to sit and listen. And if you can identify as an alcoholic, you're welcome to share. And if you can't, then we want you here to listen. And there are other 12-step programs that are our friends that we can send you to that save lives and where God lives as well. So welcome home. I didn't know what I was, and I remember reading the beautiful big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, and discovering something really curious, and that was that some old dudes from the Midwest in the 30s knew I was coming. And they knew how I thought, they knew how I acted, they drank like I drank, they did what I did, and I identified. So welcome home to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm doing all these combinations. I get married young, my girlfriend's pregnant when I'm 18 years old, and I do the right thing, and I marry her. I get a full-time job. I buy a house at 19. My daughter's born when I'm 18 and a half. We move into a three-bedroom home in Tulare, California, brand new home. We have two cars in the garage. I'm working a lot. Things look good on the outside, but I have alcoholism, and alcoholism doesn't care. Doesn't care. Folks, doesn't care at all what I got, what I love. Doesn't care how much I love my family and want to be a dad. Doesn't care about that feeling that I get when I walk down the hallway after work and I peer into my daughter's little bassinet and that little music box is twinkling and she's laying in those blankets and I'm falling in love again. Doesn't care. And a few years of living with me and that woman left, and when she left, the wheels fell off in a big way because there was nobody there to straighten up for anymore. And I started drinking with abandon. I started drinking around the clock. You mix a little cocaine in that, and it gets to be pretty lengthy. You stay up for like a week at a time, and I'm drinking all the time and doing all other crap, and I'm working for this company, and I'm getting to the point where I can't make it to work, which I've never done in my life. And I'm working for a company called Anheuser-Busch back then, and I'm working with like 40 guys who are like 10, 15 years older than I am, bad drunks, and I'm the guy they're saying, you're going to treatment, pal, or you're getting fired. And so I went to my first 30-day rehab at 22 years old in Clovis, California, called the ARC, and I showed up there and I did a 30-day spin dry. There was no detox of anything. You got off everything, and for 30 days I was sober as a judge, physically sober. I was in that place. And while I was there, they brought in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. They had sponsors coming in, meetings going out. They had everything I needed to recover from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body known as alcoholism, and I ain't buying none of it. I just want to get the heck out of here, get on with my life. Thank you very much. And I walked out of that place 30 days sober on a Friday night, and when I walked outside, I was convinced I would never drink again like I have been many, many other times. And if you'd have put me on a lie detector and asked me, will you drink again, Chuck, I'd have said no, and it would have said I was telling the truth because I meant it with everything in me. And 4 hours later, I'm in a liquor store. 4 months later, I go where tough guys go, mom's couch. And I've lost everything and don't know what happened. I've lost the house, I've lost the jewelry, I've lost the gun collection, I lost the car, and I spent all my daughter's college money that we had saved. And now I have to feed my alcoholism, so I have to start doing things, those yets in AA that those losers did in AA, I'm doing them. I'm stealing from mom and dad and taking their checks out of the back of the book. And mom and dad are running around town making up stories, taking care of covering their tracks of their sick son and doing the best they can to take care of me and be nice to me. And I'm just getting worse and worse and worse. And I start to hate myself. And if you're new tonight and you hate yourself, welcome home to Alcoholics Anonymous. The worse you are, the more we'll love you. And I started doing stuff like stealing from everybody around me, and I wake up every day with a firm resolve to not drink, and every day by noon I'm on something because I got to get it off of me. And somebody here knows what I'm talking about, the it. And I can't live with myself. I really hate me, and I'm doing things, and I'm going to bring this up because I heard a man talk about it in a meeting when he talked about it. I was sober a while, and it nailed me in the gut, and this is my story. My daughter is 4 years old, and her mother brings her over to grandma's house where I live on the weekends to visit her daddy to get some time with him. And when she shows up, I'm not there. And my daughter gets in the front window at grandma's house, and every time she hears a car door or a horn or anything, she comes running excited because daddy's here and we're going to get together and he's going to do things with me, and I don't show up. And Saturday, she runs back and forth to that window all day long, and I don't show up. And her grandma says stuff like, honey, I think he's busy this weekend. I don't think he's going to make it. And she says stuff like, no, he promised this weekend we're going to the zoo, grandma. And I would show up sometime on Sunday really sick and tired and just beat up, not slept and unkept. And I walk over to Grandma and borrow $5 so I can take my daughter to the McDonald's so I can buy one more guilt Happy Meal and tell her that story one more time. And that didn't happen one time or two times or three times. It happened week after week after week. And I love my daughter. I love her with all my heart, but I have alcoholism and it does not care. And if you live like that long enough, destroying your family and killing your kids this way, watching the disappointment in her eyes, it starts to make sense that, you know, if I wasn't around, they'd all be better off. And I become suicidal. And in our book, The Doctor's Opinion, Silkworth says that men make the supreme sacrifice rather than continue the fight. And that's what he's talking about. And I'm suicidal. And this friend of mine lived in Los Angeles and invited me to come to L.A. And I thought, if I go to Los Angeles, I would get away from alcohol and drugs forever. And it was a great plan. It didn't work very well. And I started the countless vain attempts, and not like the book says, to drink like other people. I'm starting the countless vain attempts to drink and keep the damage down. Because I'll accept a little damage to keep this thing going. And I'll also tell you why I left, too, because you need to know who's at the podium tonight. I'm a really pathetic guy, and in the grips of me on me, it gets really bad, and I do things that are despicable. And what had happened was the girl I was dating was pregnant, and when she needed me the most, I ran and I left her there. I moved away and pretended it wasn't going to happen, like a traffic ticket, like it was going to go away or something. And I moved down to L.A. and I started doing okay, and I went up there to see him, and I looked in her eyes and looked in my son's eyes. He was about 4 months old, and I said, this is it, man. I got to man up and straighten up and take care of business. And I grabbed her and threw her in the car, and I grabbed all her belongings and said, you're going to come live with me. I'm going to take care of this. This is it. I'm done. And we moved to L.A., and we were in a really nice place, part of town called Brentwood, till the rent was due. And then we were out on the street. And we moved in with this guy in the valley. And rented a bedroom from him that we couldn't pay the rent on, and we got really, really sick together. We're the alcoholic couple you might know that can't take care of their kids and can't take care of themselves. We're those people. We're the ones out in front of the Ralph's grocery store begging you for milk money so we can buy Similac, and we can't buy we try to buy it, but we walk in there and we got to get well. And this goes on for a while, and by the grace of God, in 1991, I was arrested, and that's what got me back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I believe, by a loving God and the LAPD. And I ended up in a diversion program at a case, and they were talking about sending me to prison over some priors I had. I am not a criminal. I'm the guy that calls mom crying to get me out from the jail cell, and I don't do well in jail. Look at me. I'm not built very. I'm not a big guy. I'm like an hors d'oeuvre in there, and but I like what Keith said. Keith said, it doesn't matter whether you're pitching or catching, you're still playing, pal. And I'm afraid. I'm terrified. I don't want to go to jail. But they offer me this thing called diversion. You go every Saturday morning to this place, and you pay $25 for 6 months. And then in 9 months, you go to court. And if you've done good, they drop your case. It's a really good plan. But there's a real problem with diversion. They have this particular test there that I've had trouble with my whole life called a urinalysis. I don't know how to pass a urinalysis. I'm a guy that if you know how bad I am, if I show up, if you see me somewhere, I'm always fronting myself off as sober because I'm just smoking pot or taking something. I'm not sober. And I'm afraid. I don't know how to be sober. But I've been to meetings off and on for years. My mom would lend me money to go to meetings. My sister had a really attractive girlfriend that used to call me. I'd go to a rock fight with her. She had what I wanted. And I used to go to these meetings, and I would hear this common theme in AA meetings and some of the other fellowships that I ended up in. And the common theme was this: just don't drink no matter what. Just don't drink no matter what. If you go to discussion meetings, you probably heard someone this morning say, just don't drink no matter what. It sounds catchy. It's cute. Unfortunately, telling somebody like me not to drink no matter what's like telling somebody with awful bad diarrhea, wear white and don't go. That will get very messy. See, the book says, it tells me that I'm going to drink no matter what in various ways. It says that. It says that for reasons yet obscure, the alcoholic is unable at certain times to bring into his consciousness with sufficient force the suffering and the humiliation of even a week or a month ago, that I'm without defense against the first drink. This is the baffling feature of alcoholism as we know it, the utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the wish or the necessity or the desire. I can't drink no matter what. I drink no matter what. I think it through and drink no matter what. Insanity is not doing the same thing over and over, wishing for a different result. It's just doing the same thing over and over, knowing what the result's going to be and doing it anyway. Anybody relate? Powerless. It makes me do what I already don't want to do, including it. Sober. Sober. In a state of abstinence, it convinces me, let's get drunk. I love the book. The book says something that I love where it talks about leaving the drink question aside. They tell why they were making such a hard go of life. Forget the drinking. What's wrong here? And I always return to drinking because abstinence makes me drink. And I don't know how to not drink. And I tried not drinking no matter what for 4 days. And on the fifth day, I ended up in a mental hospital, 5150. Anybody done that before here? I don't know if they have that in Nevada. It's where they four-point you to a bed and lock you up in a padded room. And that's where I went. And I'll tell you what happened. My life changed when I went there. It changed because you guys came. It changed because sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous came. It changed because this little man came by himself one night, and I had to go to this meeting, and he was a man of service. He was a guy that took time away from his busy life and his full schedule and his pleasures and his family to come in and share with people that didn't want to hear it, and I heard you. And I didn't want to hear this guy when I walked in the room, and he sat down and started talking about alcoholism like I had never heard before. And what he said was, he said he had an illness that left him different, separate, lonely, apart, and afraid his whole life. He talked about being a coward and a loser. He said his whole life that he was never a good friend to anybody, that he was a miserable brother, an awful son, and he was the worst kind of father there was. And I went, oh no. He started talking about stuff he drank, and I didn't know what he was talking about, and I wasn't sitting there shooting down everything with, well, I didn't do that, because that's me. I'm listening to this guy, and he starts talking about being sober in Alcoholics Anonymous 5 years, and that he was going back to school, and then he nailed me. He said, you know, last weekend I took my daughter to this little carnival and was riding the rides with her, and I fell apart. Because this is a time in my life where I can't even see with your kids. I have to drink. It's a stark revelation of what I am and what I've become, and I can't live with it. And I don't know why, but when that little guy kept talking, I got some hope in that meeting, and I heard the voice in my head say, Chuck, you're just like this guy. Maybe if you do whatever he's doing, you wouldn't have to live this way. And after the meeting, I asked him what to do, and he told me to go to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, go to 90 and 90. And he handed me a directory, and I grabbed that directory, and 2 days later, they released me, and I went straight to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting because I made a deal with that guy. Guy I never saw again. And I walked in my first meeting at the Valley Club in Reseda, California, and I walked in, and this old guy from New York got up to the podium. We have some friends from New York here tonight. And he walked up, and he shoveled up. He had, like, plaids that didn't match. I think he got sober when the earth was still cooling. And one of those old codgers. And he said something I'd like to share with you tonight if you're new, because it was the first thing I ever heard in an AA meeting that kind of stuck, an outside meeting that I went on my own. This is what he said. He said, I'd like to talk to the newcomer tonight and tell you that you never have to take a drink or a drug the rest of your life if you don't want to, and even if you want to, one day at a time. And I went, wow. Even if I want to? Even if I don't want to? Because even when I don't want to, I want to. And he said, stay here and listen to the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought they were going to roll a band in and start jamming or something, you know. And the music was the laughter. Music was people. Norm used to say people laughing because they were so pathetic, and they cried because they were grateful. And I started going to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for the hope. I went every day, twice a day. I went to lots and lots of meetings. I went to lots and lots of meetings. And meetings, 2 or 3 a day. And I didn't get a sponsor. Because I don't like being told what to do. I bought the book and didn't read it. I didn't get any commitments because I'm not going to be here very long. And my friend says it best. He says, from the Valley, he says, no steps, no sponsor, no service, no chance. And I didn't do any of that stuff. And 6 months and 7 days later, I picked up a drink. No, really, I drank. Which is like, what a mystery, you know, what a surprise. Because I was in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had no program, and I didn't start where I left off. I was far worse. My alcoholism had progressed to a stage that was just it was indescribable how badly I was drinking, and how much I was just it was this constant. I couldn't get enough of anything, and I was going to meetings still. I didn't stop going to meetings. And I'm the guy you might see in your home group that comes in and he's always new. That's me. I'm the guy. I'm the guy that gets 30 days and you get kind of hopeful for him and then he comes back next week new. I come to meetings late because I don't want to identify as being new. You ask me, how much time do you have? I say stuff like, I got all day, what do you need? Because I can't get any time. And I'm going to lots of meetings and I'm staying loaded and I can't even tell you why. I don't even know why. But on that morning of June the 14th, 1993, I rolled out of that bed and I was really sick. I weighed 124 pounds and I was urinating blood. And that stuff's all fine, but it was what's going on was inside that was I couldn't live with. And what was going on inside is me, I knew I was going to die and I knew I couldn't stop it. And I knew something else. And I didn't know it in here, I knew it in here. I knew that the only thing that ever worked to allow me to be with you, that ever really effectively relieved me of the bondage of self, which was taking stuff and drinking, would not work. I'm doing lots of stuff, and I'm sitting in that room crying, wondering, well, how come I can't get out and do anything? I'm crying uncontrollably, looking at the clock and wondering who's taking a cake at the meeting tonight, which is pathetic. And I don't know why, but out of complete and utter desperation, I begged to God that I didn't believe in for help on my knees. And I ended up on the phone 5 minutes later with a guy named Art Miller, God rest his soul. And Art was a kind and loving guy that I met in the meetings that was just a sweet man that always talked to me. And I used to call him my sponsor by name only, of course. And I called him up and I said, Art, this is Chuck, and I'm dying. And he said, no shit. And I said, I don't want to die like this. And he said, are you willing to go to any lengths to stay sober? And I said, yeah. And he said, well, I want you to check in this detox. Whoa, no detoxes, man. And he hung up. And I laid there and thought about my options, and I didn't have any options. If I did, there'd be somebody else here tonight. And I called him back. The book says that when there is nothing left but to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools. And I picked that phone back up and said, okay, what do you want me to do? And he came to get me, and he cleaned me up and got in the car. And he remember he said something to me. He said, Chuck, you're an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And I looked at him like, what? He said, you're an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. I said, what? He said, let me tell you what that means. It means you're going to die an alcoholic death. You're going to die choking on your own vomit or your own blood. We'll find you in the back of some car with a spike hanging out of your arm. And when you do finally die, everybody that you ever loved your whole life, people you respect, they'll be relieved you're gone. I thought to myself, I'm having a bad day here already. You got to lay that stuff on me, you know. And two words came out of my mouth. I don't say, I resented my father a lot. He was military, and I hated these words. Yes, sir. And I said, yes, sir. I don't even know what that was about. And I became convinced that day to do whatever that man said to do. And he got me active in Alcoholics Anonymous. He got me active in a home group and active with commitments. And we started doing H&I panels, taking meetings into jails and hospitals like that guy had done for me. And it's been one of the greatest gifts in my life. I've been doing that solid 4 to 5, 6 a month for the last 13 years, and I've never stopped. And it's been the thing that even when I've been unwilling or unable to do the work I'm supposed to do here, it's the thing that's kept me here. It's the only reason I could stay here, I believe. There's something magical that happens when I go out and try to give this thing away with people, when I share openly with people, when I try to listen. There's something really incredible that happens. Bob calls it a ringside seat to the greatest show on earth. I think that magic that takes place, and I started doing this stuff with these guys, I got busy, and we started doing the steps out of the 12x12, which I please don't hear the wrong. I love the 12x12, and it's a terrific book full of essays of things that further talk about the steps, but it is not the program of recovery. It is an addition to. It's almost like if you build somebody here is a builder. When you build a home, you put the foundation down, you build the frame, and you put the roof on it. That is the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. The 12x12 is the crown molding, the carpet, the tile, the marble. It is the finishing to the big book. And I didn't have that. All I had was 12x12, and I got really nutty. I did this psychobabble four-step thingy, you know, and I'll tell you, I got out some stuff in me that allowed me to be okay for a while, but I'm letting you know at about 5.5 years sober, I'm nuts. And I know what it's like to sit in the chairs of Alcoholics Anonymous and front myself off as I'm okay, and inside I'm dying because I'm doing crap that's immoral. I know what it's like to sit in the chair and know I'm doing things that I didn't learn in AA, and I'm afraid anybody's going to find out. I know what it's like to get caught up in that stuff and can't stop doing it, afraid and hating myself for the way that I am. And I'm stealing lots of money from people, and I'm okay with it, and I'm nuts over it, and I can't stop doing it, and it's killing me. And I'm not waking up in the morning and saying, you know, God, what can I do to help the other alcoholic? I'm waking up in the morning saying, can you give me enough courage to reach in that cabinet, pull out that pistol and call it a day? Because I know I can't drink, but I can't stand living with me. There's something wrong. And I was in Burbank. We have our convention coming up tomorrow. And it's been probably 10 years ago I heard this guy speak at that convention. And when I heard him talk, I don't know why, but I sat in my chair with tears in my eyes. And I'd never done that in an AA, hearing a speaker. And he knew what I suffered from. And I started working in Las Vegas. And I walked into his office, which was a liquor store at the time. And I was 6 years sober. And I walked in there and told him who I was. And he didn't know me. And I said, you don't know who I am. I'm sober longer than I've ever been, and I'm afraid. It's not really what I said. What I really said was Vegas AA sucks, and all the meetings are bad. Where are the good meetings? But that's how I said I'm afraid. And he heard that I was afraid, and he said, why don't you come to my house tonight? He gave me his card, and I thought we're going to read the book, him and I, one-on-one. He's going to fix me. And so I showed up there, and there was a bunch of people there. Craig was there, and Sheldon was there, and 80 people in that living room reading the big book and talking about this process. And I asked him to sponsor me and started doing the steps out of this book, the real fourth step. I'm resentful at what it affects. This was our course. We realized the people that wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick like me. Can I find some forgiveness? Can I do what I say at the end of that prayer every meeting? Forgive my trespasses as I forgive those who whoa, my God, that's scary. You know, I'm a guy that, you know, the old timer told me one time, if you get what you got coming to you, I don't want to be sitting next to you, pal. You know, and looking for my own faults, looking for my defects of character. What are the defects of character that if God removed, the resentment would be gone? Not what's my part. Where am I to blame? And as a result of doing that, you know, my relationship started to shift with people, with my father, with people that I'd been blaming. I had a lot of reasons to drink when I, sober a while, I had reasons to drink, and they were gone away after the fourth step. Those reasons were gone. It's a very freeing process, and if you're here and you're afraid of the steps, I'm telling you, they're here to free us. That's my experience and the experience of everybody that I know that's done them. I started doing these 6 and 7 on these problems I was having, and the scam businesses I kept getting into. And Bob told me to keep praying for the willingness and to keep asking God for help to remove these defects. And I kept trying to change different things. And one day the FBI came into where I worked and the defects were removed. Be careful what you pray for around here. Sometimes God takes that stuff more seriously than I do. And the result of that was I went from making a lot of money and being a big shot to going broke and had a labor job for a long time, and it was the best thing that ever happened to me. It taught me some values, and I started to feel like a man for a change. And I started making amends, financial amends, and a lot of the big ones for me were the ones with family and stuff like that. And as a result of the amends, my daughter is back in my life. A quick story, my father and I had a tough relationship, and I'll tell you, I started paying back some money, but I would get around my dad, and it would be kind of like there was a piece of Teflon in between us. You know what I mean? Like you try to be close, but there's something not there. And my grandfather was dying, and I called Bob and told Bob he's dying, he's up north, and they're giving him his last rites. And Bob said to me, I thought you were going to be a son. And I said, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, how come you're not there with your family? I said, it's in Fresno. I live in L.A. And he says, why don't you get the car and go up there and do what you said you're going to do? And I wasn't very happy. And I got up there, and my grandfather's dying. He's in a coma. I get there, and he wakes up like 20 minutes before I get there, and he's awake through the night. And I get to sit and talk with him, and I get to make the amend with my grandfather for being embarrassed and ashamed and not going around him and telling him how proud I was to come from that kind of a family and how you guys taught me that. I talked a lot about you guys. And the next day, my father called me up, and he's crying on the phone. This is a man that does not show emotion. And he's wanting to know what I told my grandfather. And I had this sit down with my dad, and we started to mend that relationship, and we've become very, very good friends. And that is Alcoholics Anonymous. The things that seem so impossible, if I'll do the little bitty actions, these little things that don't even make sense, big stuff gets fixed. It's incredible. I love this process. And I started doing 10 and 11. A guy from England taught me how to do, he really helped me a lot with 11. I'm not very good at practicing stuff, and he got me into this thing that I do morning in the mornings, and when I do it, I'm a lot better off, and I rarely miss it. The quiet time and the prayer and the devotion, the reading of the books, and sitting quietly and asking for God's help each day and getting some direction. And then we started this group a while back, and it's been a great blessing. We've had a lot of trouble with our group. It's like any group. There's growing pains. There's rivalries. There's all this stuff going on. And I'm lucky that we have the traditions, and I have a sponsor that understands and keeps hounding principles. So I don't react and respond the way that I react and respond. And what's happened for us is we have a lot of people staying sober in a home group that are very active, and it's a place where I hope people are attracted to. I want to leave you with a quick story. I love you guys, and I'm really glad for all you've done for me. I'm going to tell you a quick story, because if you're new tonight and you're wondering what's going to happen for you in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know I did too. I know I had dreams and expectations, and I'm letting you know that I could have never planned this stuff that's happened. Our 12-step promises talk about that. But I can't even plan the stuff that's going to happen for me. But I'm going to tell you a quick story, and I'm going to wrap it up. It's a story. It's not a religious story. It's just a cute story. And some of you have already heard it. But it's a story about these three little trees growing up in a forest. They're oak trees, and they're talking to each other like oak trees do. And one day one of them says to the other, he says, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" He says, "Well, that's easy. I want to be a great castle, home to a great king." And he says, "Oh, that's great. What about you?" He says, "Oh, me, I want to be a great ship. I want to sail all over the seven seas and haul fine merchandise and cargo and see faraway lands." He goes, "How about you do the third one?" He goes, "Oh, that's easy. I want to be a cathedral, a place where people can come and find God and find salvation." And they get split up and they get separated. And the one that wants to be a great castle gets chopped into scrap wood and shredded on the floor of this little shed thing they called a manger. And some say that a king was, in fact, born in that manger. And the one that wanted to be a great ship was cut into planks of wood, and they made these little fishing boats. And one day, this little carpenter guy got on one of those boats and sailed across the sea called Galilee with something called the gospel. And the one that wanted to be a great cathedral was cut into planks of wood. They took two pieces of wood, they nailed them together, and they called this thing a cross. And this little carpenter guy drug this cross through a town. He was flogged, he was beaten, and he was killed, and he was hung on that cross to die. And some say that he actually rose from the dead so the world would find salvation. And the moral of the story, newcomer, is this: no matter how great my plans are, God's have always and will always be greater. Thank you for my life, and thank you for letting me share.